Fanning, weekends on 2FM.
In the 1980s and the 1990s and beyond, of course, REM was one of the biggest rock bands ever, selling out huge tours of enormous domes all over the world and selling more than 85 million albums. Well, 10 years ago, September 2011, the band decided to call it a day, famously one of the most amicable and friendly breakups in the history of music. Main man Michael Stipe has popped up only occasionally over the past decade. He inducted Nirvana into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame in 2014. He released a couple of very low-key singles in the past couple of years, and he indulged in his passion for photography. His most recent book is a collection called Our Interference Times, and that was in 2019. But generally, while remaining an inspirational model of a lifelong independent creative artist and activist, Michael Stipe basically has been completely out of the limelight for 10 years. So what's been happening? Well, exclusive interview time. Let's hear from Michael Stipe after this. From REM. Hello, Michael. How are you?
Yeah, good. How's it going? Good to see you.
It's good. It's good. It's going very well indeed. Can we just jump straight in and can I start with Our Interference Times?
Yep.
Great. Okay. Now, Our Interference Times, look, is to you, from your point of view, a visual record of what?
It's me looking at the way that we look at the world before the advent of digital technology and how much that changed, how much digital technology changed the way I took photographs and the way I look at things.
You see, there's nothing written in the book about the thing, so you have to make your own interpretation. So when I heard that Douglas Copeland was involved, I assumed he was going to write some text, some accompanying text, but no, he didn't do that. So what is his collaboration? Is it that he helped just organize the pictures in such a way that they'd prevent any one image from being seen by itself?
Yeah, I mean, Doug and I have a long and very intimate friendship going back to the early 1990s. And he knows my work and he knows the way my brain thinks, or the way my brain works, actually. He knows my work and he knows the way my brain works. And he came in and basically helped me organize and categorize the different images. And it broke it down from thousands and thousands of images to what's there in the book.
And the chaos in both worlds, I'm talking here about analog and digital, do you think they're heightened when they're joined together?
Oh, that's a really good question, Dave. If what we're living through right now is any indication, I would say that they're definitely heightened. It feels like very chaotic times.
It really does indeed. And the first photo is one of you.
On the cover.
On the cover, yeah.
Yeah, it's a shot that I took of myself with my iPhone. Then I downloaded it onto my computer and then I reshot it off my computer and I got the moiré effect, which is a lot of what the book is about, is how patterns in nature resemble patterns in digital imagery and how these, in what seems like this very synthetic artificial way that we're moving away from what's real, I feel like we're actually maybe moving closer to nature in a way by embracing digital technology.
And also the photos kind of bleed off the edge of the pages as well, you know, then they sort of face and juxtapose each other. I mean, you have a grid of a big city beside a rusting gate. You have your young passport photo of yourself beside a glass window of grey structures. Like, it takes time to go through this book a few times, doesn't it? You have to, because with the, like, I'd like if Douglas had an accompanying written stuff, because I'm just interpreting this myself.
Sure. I mean, visually, and I would say in other mediums, particularly music, I've been called a maximalist minimalist, which is to say that, like, when the images are full bleed, that's a very pointed choice on my part to have this feeling of this never ending detail. And horror vacui is the fear of the empty. So you take any empty space and you jam it with as much information as you possibly can. And so I've done that with music and with lyric, in fact, but visually I've always done it. And so I'm always, it's a little bit of a push me pull you, you know, it's the double-headed llama from Dr. Doolittle. I'm kind of always pulling against myself and trying to check against my maximalist versus minimalist tendencies.
And then you never have a hierarchy between high art and low art or not art or whatever it happens to be, man-made, right back to folk art, etc., outsider art. It's all the one to you.
That's what my boyfriend said of me. And I thought it was one of the, he's very smart, but I thought it was one of the smartest things anyone's ever observed about the way I do look at things and the way that I then interpret the world that I move to and how I make that make sense for myself. As an artist and as a public figure and someone who's putting work out into the world, I'm hoping that by presenting the way I look at things, it helps other people to kind of regard the present in a different way, look at it in a different way, look at things, look at your life, look at the things in your life, look at the people in your life, look at the way that you feel, the way things make you feel in a different way, and then interpret that in a way that pushes us forward in a progressive way. That's very hippie of me, but
no, that's cool, because like, I mean, you study photography and painting at the University of Georgia, and in REM you art directed, you did all the graphics, video, stage design, alongside the writing, composing, performing as well. So all these aesthetic trends of the times, like from 80s to 90s in particular, which all trickle down to contemporary culture, as has happened in the past as well, your visibility as a media figure in all that popular culture, do you see this yourself? I mean, a lot of what you were doing, do you see it today in art and music and whatever?
Well, it's not mine to say. Thank you for suggesting that. But I mean, on some level, yes. I mean, I think there's a prescience to what we as a band were doing. And then me within the band, my contributions perhaps were slightly ahead of the curve of a few things that were happening. I don't think that we or I individually spearheaded anything, but we were certainly a part of something. Yeah.
Okay, well, you did have to step away. You've said that yourself. You had to step away from the music, and it's a long time now. It's a good decade or so. When REM ended, that is, and you stepped away from music for about 5 years or so. But I mean, have you been coming back in there in the last few years with like certain sort of solo recordings?
Yeah, I mean, I'm really enjoying composing and recording on my own. And you know, with the band, I never had to write music or compose. I responded to something that was given to me and that worked out very well. But writing and composing on my own is harder than I thought. I mean, it's not an easy thing to do. There's a bag of tricks, of course, but you don't want to, you know, you don't want to always turn to that. You want to hopefully pull something out of yourself that feels like right now. And so the work that I'm doing feels very not REM. The voice is absolutely there, but the music and the arrangements are very, very different.
Well, when you go on,
you know, what's super very important for me at the age of 61, I'm having a great time with it, and I'm doing what I want to do, and it's really enjoyable. And I hope that other people, when more of that work is released out into the world, that other people find it enjoyable as well. Who knows?
Well, I mean, everybody knows that like REM is the best example of how a band should go its separate ways, etc. And that's been well documented. But did you actually sort of feel down about music? I mean, did you have to fall back in love with music in the last 5 years and let the other 5 years happen?
No, I wouldn't say that. I just needed to step away from it. It's just very all encompassing for me. I'm a bit of a perfectionist, and within that, I despise perfection. So again, there's the push me pull you, but I never did anything half-assed, you know, whatever we put out had the stamp of I'm doing the absolute best with, I'm throwing all energy towards making this the best thing that it can possibly be. And so, you know, I had to step away from that for 5 years. Not so bad.
And obviously, but I know that you miss REM, but that you're so glad you did it. And I presume you miss performing as well, do you?
I do, yeah.
And will you get back into performing? And I have to ask, is what you're doing at the moment leading towards what I will call a solo album?
Yeah, I mean, what is an album in 2021? It feels like a marketing trend than anything else. I don't have any contract with anyone. I don't have a manager. I don't have a record company. I've just started working with a publicist who I've known for 25 years. And we hold each other in very high regard. So there's that. But yeah, Dave, I certainly miss performance. I certainly miss all of it, but I had my day in the sun, and I enjoyed it, and there's a lot of other people coming along that are doing great work and need to be listened to as well. So
Dave Fanning, weekends on 2FM.
We're talking to Michael Stipe. 51552 is our text. And when you were composing music, as you say yourself, sorry, you're composing now, but like it was really Mike and Peter and Bill or whatever that did an awful lot of the stuff and brought it to you. So now you have to do it yourself. But didn't you play classical music as a kid? And has it come back to you, Michael?
It hasn't come back. I wish I could say that it has. No, I'm a terrible musician. No, I'm a terrible painter. That we know. I'm not a great musician. I dabble around on synthesizer and keyboard, and that's how I compose. But I mostly compose with my voice. I'll come up with an idea, and I'll transcribe it onto usually a keyboard. I don't play guitar. I can't play an F or a B. I never could. What was the question?
No, I'll tell you, one of the things, I'm going to go right back even further, because one of the things about you as a kid was when the Beatles and the Stones and et cetera were happening, you were just probably too young in one way, but you were still getting into music. So as that was happening on the radio and the Beatles were just breaking down every single barrier, you were listening to pop radio, and the best for you was the Monkees and the Archies and to hell with all the other good stuff. Isn't that what it was with you?
Well, yeah, that was appropriate to a six-year-old at the time. I mean, a six-year-old should not have been listening to the Ray album.
I don't know about that.
So, I was listening to the stuff that was available to me through cereal boxes and Saturday morning cartoons. And that's the stuff that really influenced and kind of came out through my own work.
Yeah.
Beatles, God bless them, you know, they did some great stuff. I've just never really been a fan. I'm truthfully, and it's odd that we're having this conversation this week, because Charlie Watts has just left us, and that's so sad. But I always really enjoyed the Rolling Stones and their music and their arrangement and the audacity of a lot of the choices that they made as songwriters and as a lyricist, certainly.
And did a change of place do a lot for you? I mean, you've mentioned Rock On by David Essex and kind of Benny and the Jets by Elton John, who you sang for on his birthday, I believe. But also, like, when you went at 18 to Athens in Georgia, B-52s and all the rest of it, etc. I mean, did that change everything for you with the magazines that were coming out too, and Cream magazine and CBGB's in New York and Patti Smith? Did all that change for you then?
Yeah, it was a few years before I moved to Athens. It was in 1975 that I became aware of all the punk rock stuff that was going on in England, but also in the UK, I should say, but also mostly in New York and the CBGB scene and Patti Smith and television and the Talking Heads and the Ramones and Blondie. Those bands really influenced me immensely, and they pushed me to look back at the bands that had influenced them. So they dragged in David Bowie, who I'd never really paid that much attention to, the New York Dolls, Iggy and the Stooges, and very, very significantly, the Velvet Underground. These were all bands that, you know, I was way too young. I was not even 10 years old when they had their heyday. And so to discover that moment of music through punk rock,
yeah,
really gave me a toolbox of a lot of incredibly inspiring people to look up to.
And have you always been inspired by what's around? For instance, if I jump forward 20 years and go to the post-Monster album, which is New Adventures in Hi-Fi, I mean, the American West for you, and like things like, you know, Low Desert and How the West Was Won, etc. You moved to L.A. I got the impression that you found L.A. just as weird as so many others have and realised, I don't know who I am, I better get out of this place. Because even though it's Athens, Georgia, I see you as New York.
Yeah, I'm much more New York. And honestly, it's funny, I was talking about this yesterday with a dear friend. My move to Los Angeles in the early 90s really was about New York feeling just very sad and tired and depressed to me. And I think a lot of that is I associated with AIDS and the devastation that I saw in our communities through the 1980s in New York. Los Angeles is and remains the most isolating place on earth. It's not a place to go if you require the input of other people and reality as a daily dose of what keeps you going, which I do. But if you like to be isolated, LA is a place to go. And I actually think it's not very good for, I mean, I think it's maybe good for writers who need isolation, but it's not very good for anyone else.
But was it good for you in terms of a whole new set of fictional narratives, set of stories, etc.? Gave you something to write about?
It absolutely did. And that, I'm working on something right now where I spotlight that exact body of work through REM that I wrote about the American West and you know, discovering it in, through its history, but also just the feeling of being there. You know, I interpret most of the world through my feelings and for better and for worse. And that, of course, always goes into the work. So living there absolutely gave me a whole new set of themes and things to write about and think about. It was also quite distressing and upsetting ultimately. And so I now consider myself allergic to Los Angeles. I feel kind of sad for it right now. It's the people that live there, and the city itself has had a very, very rough run this past couple of years with environmental disasters left and right.
Well, at this stage, before I ask one anecdotal question about LA, I want to play this song, Electrolyte, from REM.
I'm out of here.
There you go, that's Electrolyte. We're talking to Michael Stipe. And just on that, which I think is Tom York's favourite song by REM, I might be wrong, but you mentioned Mulholland Drive and that there, but you also mentioned Jimmy Dean and Martin Sheen and Steve McQueen. As I said there. Is it really true that you shared the same, let me get this right, the same dentist?
Yeah.
The same dentist as Martin Sheen. And there he is with his mouth open, as wide as the canyon. And the dentist, come on in and meet him.
That's exactly how it happened. And I could not have been more embarrassed, but he was very, very, he was very friendly, even though he couldn't really talk because his mouth was held open with these devices that dentists use. But he was very generous. And I just said, I want you to know that I've written you into a song that's coming out very soon. And it's very complimentary. I admire you immensely. And he was very sweet about it.
Because by that stage, like, REM was so famous, it was kind of frightening. Because what you did was, you didn't really tour for about 5 years. You stayed in the veranda, as I used to always put it, in Athens, Georgia. You brought out two albums, and between them, they sold about 25 or 30 million. So it's like, hey, I'll tell you what, let's not go tour again, because that makes our album sell an awful lot more. So when you did come and tour, you did the Monster Tour. You came to Slane here in Ireland. And on that Monster Tour, we all know about the things that happened in terms of, you know, the health of three members of the band, including you, which really wasn't very good. But the tour itself and the album, did you feel that Monster had to be a kind of a tough album? Because if you were going to come out and tour, the songs on the previous tour, on the previous albums, Out of Time and Automatic to the People, were probably too soft to be playing in front of 50,000 people.
That's correct. And so we felt like we needed to write something that was harder. And we wrote a quote unquote rock album. And it has nothing to do with rock. It's more... it's much more kind of, it owes a lot to glam rock and to pop music. It's really very, very pop, but it's presenting the work through these big sounds and a lot of sound effects, and even the vocal is sound effecty. And it's all very, you know, it was very inspired truthfully by U2 and by Achtung Baby and by them deciding not to take themselves so seriously. I'm a huge fan. And of course, we've been friends since the mid 80s. Great friends. But when they put out Achtung Baby, I was like, whoa, hang on a second. This is really, really advanced and we need to respond. And so Monster was our response to U2, being as brilliant as they were with that record and with pop.
And Peter had moved to Seattle and had what? Soaked in the whole scene that was really happening huge there.
Yeah, Peter had moved out of Athens, Georgia. I was spending most of my time in New York at the time. Mike was in Los Angeles. Peter was in Seattle, and he happened to arrive into Seattle right when everything there started to take off, and wound up being, of course, neighbors. You know, Kurt and Courtney bought the house next door to Peter's so that they could, I don't know, you know, swap recipes. But he soaked in a lot of that scene and a lot of what was happening there. And I think that influenced and inspired us. You know, we were slightly older than everyone there. So it was a nice thing to have. Those relationships.
And you have spoken about Kurt Cobain before, as have other people. I get the impression sometimes when people who knew him talk about it, they're talking almost as though maybe we could have done more. You're not seriously thinking you could have done more.
Can you ask that again? I'm sorry.
I'm just wondering about, like, with Kurt Cobain, and, like, you know, he was in trouble for a long time, and his friends, people like yourself, you don't feel in any kind of way guilty, even with a small G. Like, you're not banging yourself over the head saying we could have done more for Kurt.
No, that was a very long time ago, and I did all that I could, and that's what you do when friends are in need, and
yeah,
people that you admire and love, you reach out and you offer all that you can offer, and so I did.
And so you do. So, like, just one other anecdotal thing, actually, about around that time. You went to Kansas and played the Monster Tour at the time. And Sonic Youth said, hey, do you want to come meet William Burroughs? Which is a stupid question. Did you go and meet William Burroughs?
I did. And I actually wound up writing a song about a conversation that he and I had about Kurt. And that song is called Chorus in the Rain.
Chorus in the Rain.
I think it's on Reveal. It's on one of those.
Oh,
records.
Yeah. It's on one of the later albums. Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Now,
one of my favorite, it's actually one of my favorite songs, that one. But yeah, meeting William was a big deal for me. He was very significant in Patti Smith's life, and served as a mentor to her for years and years. And so meeting him, and I lifted a lot from he and Brian Gysin and the Cut Up Technique. As a lyricist, I lifted a lot from them as writers. And so it was a great joy to meet him.
Also, you came out around that time about your sexuality. Do you ever knock yourself in the head and say, damn, I should have done this 10 years earlier?
Oh, I did it. You know, we had I was the absolute peak of my popularity. And there were not many people that had spoken openly or publicly about their sexuality at that point. And I felt like the time was right. The time was right for me, you know.
And does it matter, or are we just becoming more preoccupied with, you know, what sort of, I don't know, separates us from each other? Who cares? Identity politics and all this kind of thing.
You mean now?
Yeah.
Oh, I'm thrilled that some of the choices that I made in the late 20th century have now become so everyday that they're completely normalized in today's society. And so the 21st century has provided us with this much more inclusive way of looking at desire, at looking at gender, at looking at sexuality, and not feeling the need to put everything into very black and white kind of categories.
Yeah, do you know something, Michael? I'm just thinking, like, with Bob Dylan, Neil Young and all the rest, and a few Fleetwood Mac people, like, they've sold their back catalogue for 300-400 million quid or whatever it happens to be, and they've given it over to a different entity to do with what they will. I don't know what kind of contracts were signed. Would you do it?
Well, it's a very smart move on their part, actually. It's a very smart business move. It's a very smart move if you're at all concerned about legacy. I've given it some thought. I haven't considered it deeply. And that's something that, you know, that would be a conversation between myself and the other former members of REM. But I don't see us having to make a decision like that anytime soon. I'm a good bit younger than those people. And so bully for them, you know, they kind of took the reins and have, from a position of power, have made choices about their legacy and their work that I think are probably very smart. Do I feel compelled to do the same at this point? No.
Dave Fanning, Weekends on 2FM.
Right, welcome back. Music from REM now before we get back into talking to Michael Stipe. There you go, we're talking to Michael Stipe. And just a few more things, Michael. The receptionist for your booking agent, was that Courtney Cox?
Yes.
Okay, she was. Okay, fair enough. But were you approached to write a theme tune for a television programme that they were going to call Friends and you said no thanks?
I don't remember that. And I don't think it actually ever happened. I think we were pitched in a boardroom and someone decided that we would not probably participate in a mainstream TV show. But I mean, Courtney told me years later, because she and I are very close now and have been forever, but we also share a goddaughter, our goddaughter, Charlotte, through Jane Pratt. She's the godmother, I'm the godfather. Courtney used to, her job when REM would come to New York and we would stay for weeks at a time in a hotel on 44th Street, her job was to cook me vegetarian food. And so she told me years and years later that she did the best that she possibly could, but that sometimes it wasn't completely vegetarian. I was like, she wanted my forgiveness. And I was like, Courtney, that was 1984 or 1985, whenever the fuck it was. I don't care. It's okay. I survived. We're all here to tell the tale. It's fine.
So she's exonerated. Just as a matter of interest, you, Michael, do you think you're a good pop star or do you think you're a good rock star?
I think I was a great pop star. Yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
But if what do you think?
I, you know, I, as I said earlier, I did everything that I could to be as great as I could, and I gave everything that I had. And I often say this, you know, I'm very proud of the triumphs. I'm also very proud of the failures and the horrible mistakes and the embarrassing fall on your face moments over the course of 32 years. If that had not happened, and I'm looking back right now, I'm just doing some research, looking at some of David Bowie's least remembered moments as a public figure and as a writer. And the guy was just trying. He was doing everything. He was experimenting. He fell on his face a few times. So did I. You know, I'm okay with that.
He fell.
To answer your question, yes, I think I was a very good pop star.
Okay, but you do realize, and I'm allowed to say this, and you're not going to take it, but like as an inspirational model of a lifelong independent creative artist, Michael Stipe is up there at the very top in terms of just, here's an example of that. I mean, even what you've done in the last 10 years, even if a lot of it's under the radar, and certainly it's not in the kind of big tours or anything like that, or whatever, it's not in rock band stuff, people are following Michael Stipe no matter what you do. So do you feel any kind of... anything about the solo album, just, or is it just you're putting a bunch of songs together and hope that people like it?
Are they following? I don't really know. I mean, I think probably very famously not on social media. I ran away from it several years ago, and I regard it as a cancer in our culture. But I don't know what people think of me now, or what I never have really actually known. And now much less than ever before, because no one's telling me. So whatever I have to offer, I'm gonna throw it out there, and you know, I'll put everything that I've got into it, and hopefully someone's gonna respond to it and like it. And if not, then I'll feel like I'll have done something, you know.
So do you think you might be kind of lucky that you bowed out, sorry, REM bowed out a day, you know, just literally before social media became ubiquitous?
Is that how it happened?
Okay.
Well, there we are, pressing again.
I mean, are you kind of like, are you looking at it saying the way the politics is just kind of, I don't know, shaped by it now? We know Donald Trump never sat one-to-one with anybody except on Fox News, and he's just tweets these repellent things every second day of the week for the last 5 years.
Yeah, I mean, he's a thing of the past, thank God. And yet we have the ripple effects of that horrible 4 years to deal with for a very long time, including, of course, yesterday's pullout of Afghanistan. So, very, very sad. But I forgot whatever the question was. If it were,
well, no, it's just that like politics is being shaped, whether you like it or not, by social media.
The whole world is being shaped by digital technology and by social media. We need to take a step back and get a little Buddhist on and acknowledge and recognize how much this is changing, not just politics, but ourselves and the way that we communicate with each other and the way we regard each other and the way we regard ourselves.
Okay, but I just want to get back finally to the our interference times. Just a few little bits about that again. As I mentioned, Douglas Copeland, I thought he might have been writing sort of the thing. But, you know, when you put this book out and when you have people, like, for instance, you're fascinated by corners.
Yeah, I like corners.
What does that mean exactly? I mean, like, do you think... I'm not sure where that brings us. Like, if you think that digital technology does bring us closer to nature or should bring us closer to nature, I don't get all the connections in the book.
I'm sorry. Well, I always never want to be mysterious with these things. And so corners, if you speak to a draftsman or a draftswoman, a corner, if you follow the line of a corner into infinity, it just keeps going and going and going. And a corner is simply where three lines that are infinite cross and create something that actually has always existed, but only ever existed in the abstract. Now it exists because of us in every room of our house. And so that's probably my fascination with corners. That's why we created, it's not an object, but it's a thing that's a non-thing, but it's also where the room ends, you know.
Okay, well, finally, Michael, one last question would be that I mentioned Aaron Dessner earlier on from the National, and you have the song that I played, No Time for Love Like Now. And, you know, I mentioned also Douglas Copeland. So do you think that you work well with others, in tandem with others, or do you think you need somebody else?
I do work well with others. Yeah, I do. I get inside my head and I don't sometimes know what's good and what's not good. And so it's great to have people to bounce ideas off of, and also I'm I'm a bit of a one-trick pony, you know. So I need other people to create with, and I've enjoyed that through the books, and I've enjoyed it with music and other mediums.
Michael, it's been a real pleasure as usual, and thank you so much. And we'll see you again as well when the album comes out. Thanks a million, Michael.
Thank you. Good to see you.
Dave Fanning, weekends on 2FM.